The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. We finally came to a conclusion of the programs that were dealing with the Big Bang last time and are looking now at the gap that exists between energy and atoms. I really have not read a lot about this. I've read a few articles, but it seems to me to be a reasonable dilemma for the evolutionist. If you start with the simplest of atoms, namely hydrogen, composed of a proton and an electron, and then have some understanding of the nature of the other atoms, there presumably are 92 or 90, depending on your persuasion, naturally occurring elements, that is, that occur in nature that man has not been able to synthesize in laboratories. If you accept Huxley's criteria for evolution, this is supposed to go from simple to complex, and the simplest of the elements then would be hydrogen, and hydrogen therefore would be, according to his notion, the basis of all of the rest of the elements that we find ourselves able to determine existing around us. I cannot avoid observing that when we start talking about the conditions that would had to have prevailed in order for hydrogen to be the only element present, the simplest, which was getting ready to give rise to all the others, we are again talking about something that simply is beyond the possibility of scientific information. Now, you can believe what you want to about it, but the fact remains we don't have any scientific information about that. And the theories that are going to be derived and the evidence that is going to be dredged up to try and support those theories has nothing to do with science. And as long as this is kept in mind, then we can discuss notions about that. One of the things that has intrigued me as I have thought about this over the years, the next element, the next heaviest element, of course, is helium. Now, helium has some components in it that hydrogen does not have. Most of you who've been to school have at least some concept of the idea of atomic weight and molecular weight and so on, and I am not intending to teach a class in chemistry and pursue that with you. But hydrogen is very simple. Having a single proton, it has an atomic weight of one. Helium, on the other hand, the next lightest, has an atomic weight of four. It has two protons, but it also has two different subatomic materials and particles in it, namely neutrons. Now, where are these things going to come from? Supposedly, neutrons are some combination of other subatomic particles that have no electrical charge on them. And again, this is not the topic of what I'm interested in talking with you about right now here. But in order to change from hydrogen to helium, there would have to be a neutron source. Now, the neutron sources that I am familiar with are not the sorts of things that are going to be conducive to hooking subatomic particles together. The fact is they're going to have exactly the opposite of that effect. Now, where they came from is a mystery, and how this neutron source could be used with a collection of hydrogen in order to produce helium is not only unknown, but unknowable as well. And there are elements about this that simply do not make any sense. Now, you can start down through that trail of going from simple to complicated atoms. You get down to the higher ones. Uranium, an obvious example, 230 something or other, 38, 39, 30 varieties of that, depending on the number of protons, the protons and neutrons that are there. And one other little tidbit that's worth giving some thought to is that many of these elements, as you get on, particularly up into the heavier elements, are unstable. They are slowly decomposing. They are losing, giving off energy or matter, and actually changing over a period of time into something else. One of the most well-known of these things is the sequence to go from uranium to lead. Uranium, an unstable element, which makes it desirable then in making atomic bombs, for example. But it is going to change through some 15 different stages down to a stable end product, lead. So in some cases, once the element has been, I hate to use the word created here, but has formed as a result of the evolutionary process, it's going to turn right around and start deteriorating again. And as I think I observed early, evolution is a process which is going to have to work by itself in nature. And to think that there are simply forms of energy or matter or phenomena or conditions that are somehow going to bring about this kind of change simply lies beyond any sensible view of evolution, in my opinion. It is true that we have learned how to change, theoretically, any element into any other element now. But the fact that that can be done is not an argument to support the notion that it happened initially that way. It would seem to my mind to indicate that it requires intelligence to begin with, and then not only intelligence, but a great deal of time and money and effort as well. The alchemists of the Dark Ages are known primarily for their attempts at trying to translate base metals, lead and others, into gold and silver. Is it possible to do that? Is it possible to change lead into gold? Well, the answer to that, of course, is yes. General Electric did that a number of years ago. It was a little expensive. My recollection, it cost something like $230,000 for a fraction of an ounce of gold, but it's possible to do it. It's not that the alchemists were attempting to do something impossible, but they were attempting to accomplish one of the most difficult physico-chemical kinds of reactions with no instruments, no knowledge that would allow them to do that. But simply because it has been done is not a reason to argue that it could have happened in nature by itself. The evidence would seem to indicate quite the reverse of that. Now, most evolutionists would argue today, well, yeah, we understand all the problems and all the difficulties, but all the elements are here. Well, yes, we're not arguing about whether they're here or not. We're arguing about how they got here. And is it reasonable to use evolution, a process of matter and motion, matter and force and motion interacting, a reasonable basis for the presence of all of the different elements that we see? And in my opinion, it simply is not. There is a rather interesting quote that came to my attention by George Wald, a fairly well-known name in a variety of areas, including part of what we have been talking about. George Wald wrote a book, Biological Science and Inquiry into Life. It was published by Harcourt, Brace, and Worrell back in 1963. And there are a couple of comments from that book that I think perhaps are pertinent here. George Wald obviously is an evolutionist. Quote, if life comes only from life, let me stop here for a moment. This is the idea of biogenesis, which again is probably the best known law, the most stable law, the law in which we can have the most confidence in biology of any other. And there have been no known exceptions to it. I'm not aware of any evolutionist that really is willing to argue to defend the idea that life can come into existence from something other than previous life. This is what is known as spontaneous generation. And it has been disproven rather consistently by biology for the last 150 years or so. So it is not a job that most biologists, evolutionary or otherwise, want to take on. But this is the idea that is being referred to here. If life comes only from life, does this mean that there was always life on the earth? Now notice George Wald's answer to that question. It must. He is arguing then that life has always been in existence. Now there are perfectly reasonable arguments against that, philosophical as well as scientific. Let me go on with his quotes. If life comes only from life, does this mean that there was always life on the earth? It must. Yet we know that this cannot be so. So he has accepted those reasonable arguments that indicate that it is simply not possible that life could always have been into existence. One simple answer to that would simply be that the earth hasn't always been in existence. And it seems to me we discussed before the notion of life coming to earth from other planets, and we'll talk about that again in another session probably. It must, yet we know that this cannot be so. We know that the world was once without life, that life appeared later. We think it was by spontaneous generation, end quote. Now, this is not something that is a welcome idea to the evolutionist, but it is simply the only possibility if they have rejected the idea of a omniscient, omnipotent creator who created it. So rather than accept the evident answer, they will reject that and turn to something which is nonsensical at best. They shall turn away their ears from hearing the truth, and they shall be turned unto fables. And this is an excellent example. George Wald is certainly an intelligent man. It's not a lack of intelligence or intellectual ability or smarts, knowledge of science. That's not the reason. There's another reason why he would make this choice. And to find a man of his stature who rejects the idea of life having existed on the earth forever, although it would be appealing, that's the position he has come to, and he's forced then into the position of deciding that it's simply spontaneously generated, that living things originated out of non-living material. This is another gap that we're getting ready to talk about, but it's an idea that any thoughtful person simply does not waste a great deal of time or effort considering as a possibility.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson@bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.